Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It sounds like a cue for protests and howls of blasphemy. The ex-queen of vampire tales and goth fiction assuming the voice of Christ. Instead, the second volume of Anne Rice's novelized Life of Jesus series has evangelicals swooning. Here, Jesus is a poor carpenter at 30, in love with a woman half his age, coming to terms in a dusty backwater town with a divinity and mission that will not be denied. This hour, On Point novelist Anne Rice, on her road from vampires to Jesus, and the latest in her Christ the Lord series. Joining me now from her home in Rancho Mirage, California, is Anne Rice, an American novelist best known for her vampire chronicles. Anne stunned her enormous readership in 2002 when she pledged to write, quote, only for the Lord. Her new book, second in her Christ the Lord series, is Christ the Lord, The Road to Cana. Evangelical David Kuo, one-time deputy of President Bush's faith-based initiatives, calls the novel a wonder and its Jesus a revelation. The New York Times says today the book perches on the edge of blasphemy. Anne Rice, welcome to On Point.
Hello. I'm glad to be with you.
There you are, as the Times would have it, perched on the edge of blasphemy. Is that a comfortable place for you? Is that where you aimed?
Well, no, I don't think I'm perched on the edge of blasphemy, but you know, this novel does have a very high level of realism. I tried to make it very, very realistic. And of course, some people reading it told me that they read it with trepidation. They were afraid at any moment that I was going to go over a line and they were going to have to stop reading it. But I didn't go over that line. Well, you know, so maybe Janet Maslin is right. Maybe it's perched up there, but it doesn't become blasphemy. And I think that's what readers are telling me, and that's certainly what the early readers, the early clergymen who read it, told me, that it is not blasphemy, that they think it's a very realistic portrait of what life might have been like for our Lord when he lived in Nazareth.
Anne Rice, I wish you'd be good enough to put us at that spot in the life of Jesus where you set your book. Where is he in life, in his journey from childhood to destiny, when you catch up with him in The Road to Cana?
Well, it's the last winter before he's going to go to the Jordan River. And John the Baptist has not come out of the wilderness yet. So nobody in Nazareth, including the Lord, you know, is aware of when John will come and make that call for all to be baptized. And my hero here, and it really is my hero, is Jesus Christ, in whom I believe completely, and it's the Jesus of Scripture. But I believe it's a Jesus who has put aside his divine knowledge in order to experience some things through his human knowledge. So he doesn't know exactly what's going to happen that winter. He wants to find things out as a human being, and that's how he's been experiencing things on earth. I think the Gospels give us a lot of clues that Jesus did live in that way. You know, that he was angered from time to time, that he marveled at things, that things surprised him. And so I pick him up in that last winter, and Nazareth is in a drought that, you know, which is a fictional thing that I brought in. And he's really embroiled in life in the village, and I'm trying to give a picture of what life might have been like in a town like Nazareth, especially for a man over 30, like Jesus, who refuses to get married.
Is it frightening for an author like yourself, even with your stature, your huge sales, 100 million copies over the years, is it frightening to pick up a character as fraught as Jesus with all his millions of believers and followers and others, atheists and others who will say, why are we even talking about this? The possibility of offending or you know, falling into some kind of maelstrom seems so high. Does it leave you on edge as you write a book like this?
I was very frightened. I was scared to death. But I believed very much in these books. I believe very much in writing novels about Jesus and trying to bring Jesus to life for many, many readers who've never really taken him seriously, never really believed in him, or maybe just never thought about his humanity. I mean, they may believe in his divinity, but they don't think much about what the incarnation means, what it means that he came down here, was born as a baby, and lived for 30 years, over 30 years on this earth. And I see this as something that I passionately want to do. I told him that I want to do this. I consecrated these books to him, and I said, I want to do this. I think people in America are crying for Christian art. They're crying for it, and they just don't get it most of the time for the very reasons you described. People are too scared to do it.
We want to understand.
People in Hollywood are scared. You know, they don't know how to really make a movie like Mel Gibson did, so we don't get good Christian movies, and sometimes we don't get really good Christian novels because people are afraid.
We want to understand your own path to the religiosity that you exercise today, Anne, but to get a sense of the book itself, I wish you'd read a bit for us from right at the top of Christ the Lord, The Road to Cana. Could you give us a sense? Here you are, Anne Rice, writing in the first person, essentially, as Jesus.
Well, I'll do that, but I ask you to allow the fact that I don't read real well for my work. But I'm going to do it. I have it here. This is the first page. This is how the novel opens. Who is Christ the Lord? Angels sang at his birth. Magi from the east brought gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. They gave these gifts to him and to his mother Mary and the man Joseph who claimed to be his father. In the temple, an old man gathered the babe in his arms. The old man said to the Lord as he held the babe, a light for revelation to the Gentiles, and glory for your people Israel. My mother told me those stories. That was years and years ago. Is it possible that Christ the Lord is a carpenter in the town of Nazareth, a man past 30 years of age and one of a family of carpenters, a family of men and women and children that fill 10 rooms of an ancient house, and then in this winter of no rain, of endless dust, of talk of trouble in Judea, Christ the Lord sleeps in a worn woolen robe in a room with other men beside a smoking brazier? Is it possible that in that room, asleep, he dreams? Yes, I know it's possible. I am Christ the Lord. I know. What I must know, I know, and what I must learn, I learn. And in this skin, I live and sweat and breathe and groan. My shoulders ache. My eyes are dry from these dreadful rainless days, from the long walks to Sepphoris, through the gray fields in which the seeds burn under the dim winter sun because the rains don't come. I am Christ the Lord. I know. Others know, but what they know they often forget. My mother hasn't spoken a word on it for years. My foster father Joseph is old now, white-haired and given to dreaming. I never forget. And as I fall asleep, sometimes I'm afraid because my dreams are not my friends. My dreams are wild like bracken or sudden hot winds that sweep down into the parched valleys of Galilee. But I do dream as all men dream. And so this night, beside the brazier, hands and feet cold under my cloak, I dreamed.
Anne Rice, reading from her new book, Christ the Lord, The Road to Canaan. I should say you can read an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Anne, so many of your readers came to you when you were writing about vampires. Can you explain what happened in your life? What brought you from that, what the times and others call, sort of semi-pornographic vampire stories, to the piety that is obviously apparent in your work and attitude now? What happened? What was that about?
Well, the first thing that really happened was that I went back to my faith in 1998. I'd been an atheist for many, many years, and I think the Vampire Chronicles reflect that atheism. They reflect a kind of grief for a lost faith. And they talk about that darkness, that aloneness of a person drifting through the world who doesn't believe in God. But in 1998, faith was restored to me. I almost read myself back into belief, you might say. I was studying and searching and pondering and meditating, and one afternoon in 1998, I thought, look, you believe in him. You love him. You want to go back to him. So put aside all the theological questions you can't answer and forget the sociological questions that are driving you crazy. Go home. Go home to him. And I got up out of the chair and I went back to the church. I went back to the church of my childhood. I went to confession and I became a Catholic again with a full heart. I mean, just a joyful heart. And that was really the beginning of the great change in me. The final consecration of my work to him didn't come till 2002. By that time, I had written a couple more, maybe three more novels, and they involved the vampires, and they were semi-religious, and you could see that these novels were moving toward redemption, but, you know, it wasn't, it was still something I was uncomfortable with. And I was sitting in church talking to the Lord, and I was thinking, how can I do your will? How can I say to you, thy will be done to me? I mean, what am I going to do? I'm writing these books. I have 49 employees. I've got a huge family. I've got a lot of people dependent on me. I've got several kids in college, you know, that I'm putting through, relatives. What am I going to do, Lord? How can I give everything away and follow you, as the Gospels say? And it suddenly occurred to me, okay, you can't do that, but you can give all your work to him. You can consecrate everything you are going to do from now on to him. You can say, all my writing will be for you. Mm. Any talent I have, anything I've learned about constructing a book, any ability to tell stories, I'm going to consecrate it to you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Anne Rice, American novelist, best-selling author of The Vampire Chronicles, which stretched from way back in 1976 to the last coming out in 2003, or perhaps the last. We'll talk about that. In 2002, she pledged to devote her writing to God. Her first book in that series was Christ the Lord Out of Egypt in 2005. Now she's out with her latest, Christ the Lord, The Road to Cana. It finds Jesus as a 30-year-old in dusty, drought-stricken Nazareth and coming to terms with a divinity that cannot be denied, as Anne Rice tells the story. She joins us today from her home in Rancho Mirage, California. And I wanted to read to you something that David Kuo wrote. Some of our listeners may have heard it. This was a review that he gave to National Public Radio's All Things Considered. And he said that he's a big fan, this evangelical, former deputy director of the Office of Faith-Based Community Initiatives in the White House. But he liked the book a lot. He said it's a portrayal desperately needed in this day when some theologians have rendered Jesus little more than the accidentally crucified socialist and others as an aspiring head of the RNC, as in Republican National Committee. He says that the reality is that Jesus has been lost in the context of our time, reduced to an almost cartoonish amalgam of Cesar Chavez, Mr. Rogers, and Pat Robertson. It is precisely this caricature of Jesus that Anne Rice undoes in her new book. Anne Rice, he calls the book a wonder, your Jesus a revelation. You take a book and maybe a whole series to do it, but what is the broad outline of the character that you're looking to portray here, Anne Rice?
Well, the character is the Jesus in whom I believe. I mean, this is the Jesus of the Apostles' Creed. This is the Jesus of the Bible. I believe he is God and man. I believe he came down to earth just as we are told in the Gospels. And he became man, and this is the story of the incarnation. This is one of the greatest love stories in all literature and all religions worldwide. The story of Almighty God coming here and becoming a human being to be with us, not just for several minutes on Mount Sinai or 40 days, but you know, coming here to live with us, to suffer with us, to walk with us, to know us. And I'm trying to capture that Jesus, fully divine, fully human, and give a probable reality. I'm trying to take whatever gift I have for writing novels. Look, you know, my novels made people believe in vampires. Mm. They would call me and ask me if they were real. So I thought, if you can do that, maybe you can make the Lord real for somebody. And, of course, this is fiction. This is a probable Nazareth. This is a probable Jesus, of course. But it's my attempt to present him in a way that readers can really pick up this book and just get right into it and say, yes, yes, I mean, of course he was divine, he was human. I never thought about it before. I mean, that's very much what I'm trying to do. I mean, it's very, very, very scary, and it's very difficult because I believe in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I believe completely in the Gospels. I came out of years of biblical study on the side of the four Gospels as the most reliable and complete information we have about Jesus.
But the love that's talked about so much in the Gospels is a kind of universal love. In this story, the love that the story revolves around is much more earthly. It has to do with a distant relative of Jesus named Abigail, the town beauty in Nazareth. He's 30, she's 15. And they are desperately in love, though, a kind of doomed love, as you tell us. Give us the outlines of that relationship and why you put it at the heart of this book.
Well, I would disagree that they're in love. I would say Jesus is not in love with her. I would say he loves her very much, and he recognizes that if he were to marry, she would be the ideal person. And part of this book is his refusal to marry, his insistence that where he's going, he has to go alone. He can't take a wife and children with him. But the story of Abigail in the village is really a story of a young woman in a village that's very harsh on her and very judgmental of things that happen. And what happens to Abigail in Nazareth is happening to women today in the Middle East. I mean, she suffers shunning because she is attacked by bandits who mishandle her. They don't, in fact, violate her. Nevertheless, her father is so ashamed that she's put away and shunned. And Jesus, out of tremendous love for her and compassion, tries to do something to help her. But he's not in love with her. This is not a Christ who is lusting after Abigail. I think that would be a very mistaken vision of this book. And I think the readers who've read it, you know, would agree with me. He, of course, he feels great compassion for her, and she teaches him what intimacy might mean if he were to be able to allow himself that, and he can't. And that's part of what he gives up for us. That's part of what he suffers for us as a man. God, as a man, knows he cannot marry, he cannot take a wife and children where he's going to Golgotha, and he does not consider marriage with Abigail. He can't do it. And of course he's surrounded by people pressuring him to get married, because that's the way Jewish life was at that time. You were really expected to marry.
In the midst of that storytelling, I couldn't stop thinking about how much it must be for an author like yourself to deal with expectations. I mean, on the one hand, we referenced Janet Maslin's review in the Times today of the story, and she says there, the humanity in your book, The Road to Cana, nearly takes the form of bodice ripping. She's quoting you then, "The man in me knew that we were alone, and the man in me knew that I could have this woman." On the other hand, you've got Ron Charles in the Washington Post saying, you know, he appreciates your reverence and piety, but as a reader, he writes, "I kept wishing some gay vampires would swoop in to liven things up." I mean, it puts you in some spot there, Anne.
Well, I would dismiss the gay vampires out of hand. I mean, that is not going to happen. That is just patently ridiculous. Now, as for Ms. Maslin's statement, grateful as I am for her review, I have to say that referring to Abigail's emotional dilemma as a bodice ripper is a bit denigrating, and maybe is a bit misogynist. I mean, the emotions of women and what they suffer in Middle Eastern villages and what they suffered in those times when they were shunned and when they were driven to desperation is not bodice ripping. I mean, something else is going on there. Jesus loves this girl, and this girl is suffering at the hands of the people of Nazareth. I'm trying to present what the town was like, the harshness of life. This has nothing to do with a bodice ripper. And frankly, I think I'm grateful to Ms. Maslin for many, many other things she said in her review, but that certainly isn't one of them.
But you're accustomed to this, people seeing you and reading you in the enormous context of all your work that came before. You came out late last summer with a whole essay entitled On Earlier Works.
That's true.
Where you look to address it. You wrote that in 1976, I felt that the vampire was the perfect metaphor for the outcast in all of us, the alienated one in all of us, the one who feels lost in a world seemingly without God. But then you say you never dreamed that you'd become so so tied to this word, this idea of vampire. You say, as I looked back on it, you wrote, I have to say that the use of this word, vampire, did indeed bring me popular attention, but it brought me that attention at a dreadful price. What is that price, Anne Rice?
Well, this sort of denigration, this sort of insult, this sort of dismissal, people mentioning, you know, gay vampires or referring to my work as bodice ripper. I mean, that type of thing. I mean, when I first used the word vampire in Interview with a Vampire, there was not a whole crowd of people writing about vampires at that time. And it was a relatively, I thought, interesting idea to tell the story of a vampire and have him talk philosophically about what it was like to live that kind of alienated existence. Well, since that time, we've had many, many people write about vampires, and there's a whole genre now of vampire literature, and people associate this with Buffy the Vampire Slayer and with different movies that they see, and my work has suffered as the result principally at the hands of people who have not read it. They have not read my novels, and if they would read them, they would discover that they are certainly not in bodice rippers, not a single one of them ever.
Anne Rice,
that's not what they do.
A lot of listeners want to speak with you. I'd love to turn to them, if I may. Anne Rice joins us from her home in Rancho Mirage, California. John's calling us right now from Medford, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Anne. Thank you so much for writing this book.
And
I can say, as a gay man, I didn't interpret anything as bodice ripping. I grew up in Kentucky, lifelong Roman Catholic, seminary educated, very alienated from the church, not just for being gay, for a number of issues, but I find myself now as an atheist, and I wonder how I got here. I read your book, Cry to Heaven, about the castrati, and as a singer and a musician, I was just blown away by the beauty of your writing. I came to the series of Christ the Lord with some trepidation, but I'm very moved by it. I'm very moved by the laughter, the humor you bring to Jesus' family, knowing of the stories when he brings the rain, when he prays to the Father for rain, and the beautiful telling of the wedding feast at Cana, especially the interplay between Jesus and his mother. I love it so much. It means so much to me. And I don't know if I'll find my way back to my Catholic faith, because you know how the church is, and I mean, your son, who I've done his reading to, I'm babbling on, but thank you so much. And I just would like to ask you, have you finished the entire series of the books? How long will we have to wait before we can read the rest of this journey?
John, you said so many wonderful things. It's going to take me a while to finish. I'm on the third book now, and I'm on the fourth. But let me say something to you about being a gay man and about being a Catholic.
Yes.
Don't let anybody stand between you and Jesus Christ. Please don't. Don't let any church stand between you and Jesus Christ. You go to him. He is the man at the top. And he alone will judge the living and the dead. So if you want to go back to church, you go back.
Thank you.
John, thanks very much for your call. And your son, Christopher, is quite openly gay and out, and a writer himself. Has the Catholic Church's position on homosexuality caused personal pain for you?
Oh, yes. It caused a great deal of personal pain. And I'm very proud of Christopher. Christopher is one of the most conscientious, clean-living individuals I know. He's just published his new novel, Blind Fall. He's very successful as a novelist. And it caused me agony back in 1998. But what happened at that moment was, I put my trust in God. I thought, okay, I don't have to solve this, what's going to happen to my gay friends and my gay son. The Lord will solve this. The Lord knows. And I put my trust in him that he knows what everybody suffers, what everybody experiences. And I maintain that trust. It's part of my faith. It's part of my love for God. When I go into church on Saturday evening for Mass and I kneel down and I pray, I mean, I'm not worried about my gay son going to hell. That's in the hands of God. And I pray for everybody. And I pray for myself. And I pray for God to strengthen my faith and my love. And I get wonderful letters from gay Christians. And some of them are very hurt. And some are alienated. And some aren't. Some are going to church. They're going to church. And there's a gay evangelical site on the web. there are many gay people who want to worship with us, and they want to be part of us. And they're hurt by the fact that maybe we don't open our arms enough and say, look, come in and let God judge this.
John, thanks for your call. Let's take a call from Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Betty. Betty, you're on the air with Ann Rice.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And I don't, at any moment, disregard your faith. And I do believe that there's certain things that you can say to the Lord in your private prayer closet. But I believe in the writing of these books, you have trivialized my Lord. You have made him much too common. And I'm sorry that you use your skill in this form at this time. Thank you very much.
Betty, thanks for your call. Ann.
Yeah, I'm very sorry to hear that. I really am, but I understand, and I respect that view. I did set out to show our Lord as human. I did set out to make his humanity understandable to us, and I'm saddened by that, of course, but, you know, I have to accept that. That's the way this person feels. I can say from the mail I received that I received very, very, very few letters that express that view, but I understand.
Betty, thanks for your call. And let me invite another voice into our conversation for a moment, if I may. Joining us from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, is Bill Leonard. He's Dean of the Divinity School at Wake Forest University, a professor of church history. Professor Leonard, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Have you had a chance to look through Anne's latest book, Christ the Lord, the Road to Cana, Bill?
I have, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And you know the Bible, you know the story, you know the spirit of the biblical story. What do you make of, here you've got a very, very potent storyteller in Ann Rice, proven again and again and again, taking the story in hand, giving it her own interpretation, its own life through her treatment. What do you make of it as a scholar of Christianity?
Well, I think it represents yet another way of revisiting Jesus. And as I've listened to Ms. Rice today, I think we find that Jesus becomes this transforming experience, this transforming presence in the lives of so many people, and there are so many facets, so many ways in which we tell and retell the Jesus story. And this is one of those that obviously grows out of a very deep and renewed spiritual commitment on her part. And the way she tells this story gives us insight into not only the Jesus of the Gospels, but into Jesus, the contemporary presence that as she's experienced him. I might tease her a bit and say I think her view of Jesus seems both ancient and postmodern in the way she's articulating him and putting him into a particular context that, in a way, certainly informs our current context.
And what do you mean by ancient? What do you mean by postmodern?
Well, I think she retells the Jesus story and reminds us of pieces, the way in which the Gospels shape our understanding of Jesus and the story of Jesus. But I think the localism of Nazareth as normative, the quest for self-identity, Jesus' own search to engage his personal story with the grand narrative of Israel and nationhood and God, whom Jesus calls Father, all of those have little hints of the postmodern from my academic perspective, and I find that very fascinating.
And did you try to portray him as somebody 2,000 years ago might have, or just embrace the portrayal by a Christian looking on in 2008?
I really did try to write from the point of view of somebody living in the first century. I tried very hard not to project anachronisms back on him. But any writer who writes about Jesus or makes a film or a miniseries or anything is going to put something of himself and his time or herself and her time into that portrayal. That's bound to happen, and I think Bill Leonard is right on. I've done that in some ways. You know, that's inevitable. But I made every effort, really, to write the Jesus of the first century, to write him as he would have been in that town.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with American novelist and best-selling author of The Vampire Chronicles, Anne Rice. In 2002, she pledged to devote her writing to God. Her first book in that series was Christ the Lord Out of Egypt. Her new latest book in that series, Christ the Lord, The Road to Cana. And it tells her version of the sort of story, the life of Jesus at about the age of 30, of love and trial as he moves toward a kind of acceptance of divinity at that point in his life. Anne Rice joins us from her home in Rancho Mirage, California. We've also been joined from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, by Bill Leonard, Dean of the Divinity School at Wake Forest University and a professor of church history. And I wanted to ask you, Bill, if I could, just before we lose track of it, we had Betty calling just before the break from Virginia Beach, who said she accepts Anne's Christian devotion, but she feels that making this story, this kind of telling of the story, so public makes Jesus, in her view, too common. What do you say to that, Bill?
Well, I think the Jesus story was at the beginning and remains scandalous. And each of us read and hear Jesus in various ways. We all wear different glasses. We read Jesus through the tradition that we have. Ms. Rice speaks of returning to her Catholic tradition. I speak out of a Baptist tradition. And I think the phone call for me was an illustration of sort of the scandalous nature. On one level, Jesus transcends so many sectarian divisions and traditions. On another level, when you mess with Jesus, you deal with the vision that people have of him, and that sets us at odds. So he is at once the welcoming person and the person who scares us and who we draw lines around him for better or for worse.
Anne, do you agree? Did you feel that kind of scandalous quality to the narrative line of the Jesus story? And did that make it familiar to you? After all, your vampire books were again and again in scandalous territory.
Oh yes. I mean, we often speak of the scandal of the cross, the crucifixion of Jesus. I mean, it was a scandal that the Messiah was crucified and rose from the dead. And this is the scandal at the heart of the story of Jesus. But one of the things I'm trying so hard to do in these books is to take all of the Gospels. I believe it all. I'm not some liberal who's going to say the Magi didn't come. You know, I state right up front, they did come. I'm not going to say the angels didn't sing. I believe they sang. And I'm trying to make a realistic novel in which all of the Gospel elements are truth. And that's why it saddens me that Betty feels I'm trivializing the Lord. I feel that a lot of art about Jesus, a lot of books about Jesus, don't do that. They throw away a good deal of the Gospels. I'm not throwing away anything. I want to make him, the Lord in whom I believe, and yet I want to make him real, and I want him to talk and walk and move like a character. And really, you know, writing from his point of view, it's not that different from the lines that are written in miniseries or movies by Mel Gibson or anybody else who writes about Jesus. Inevitably, they put words in his mouth, they have him speak, they have him look a certain way. I'm trying to do this in fiction.
You had, speaking of movies, you had Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise in your vampire films. You told ABC News that if the series, the Christ the Lord series, would come to the screen, you could imagine Johnny Depp in the role of Jesus. Do you see this headed that way, Anne?
Well, I do hope someday this will come to the screen, but I think I'll have to be very heavily involved in it, and it will have to be a believer. It'll have to be somebody like Mel Gibson to do it and to do it right. And we will need biblical scholars to help us get everything right. I do think Johnny Depp would be wonderful. I thought that if you've seen all his movies, if you've seen all the quiet and deep movies he's done, as well as the fun movies, he definitely has a wonderful face and a wonderful depth, and he could play Jesus. But I don't know if that's going to happen. You know, right now, I want to get the other books written. I want to get that done before I think about movies. The movies can sweep you off track, you know. They can involve you in a lot of things, and then maybe nothing comes of it. And my ministry, my vocation, is to write these books.
Anne Rice's ministry. Let's go to Mindy in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Mindy. You're on the air.
Hi. It's a pleasure to hear Anne Rice. She's a wonderful writer.
And I wanted to ask you if you, I know that you say you take the New Testament writing literally, but do you see a similarity between yourself and the authors of the New Testament in that you're trying to present to the public a personal interpretation of Jesus and of perhaps of God, religion? And if you feel that your work at this point in your life is somehow divinely inspired, whereas your vampire novels were not. Thank you.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because I wouldn't dare say that I was divinely inspired. I hope and pray that these books are for Christ. They are for Him. If they're not for Him, if they do not bring people to Him, they are worthless. And I hope and pray that the Holy Spirit is guiding me. I hope and pray that I am doing something, again, that will bring people to Jesus, to Christ. And that is my only goal. And certainly with the vampire novels, no such things were on my mind. Those were simply imaginative works that reflected doubts and questions and pain and suffering without a solution, without a possibility of redemption. And this is something for me that is a real vocation. It is, I hope, a holy thing to do. But I would never be so proud as to say that I know for sure that it is.
But Anne, there was something a little mischievous in Mindy's question there. She's suggesting that the Gospels had the imprint of their authors in them, the human imprint of their authors, and asking if you sort of find yourself in line with that tradition, where there are events. There is a story told. The story, historians now suggest, you know, with some embellishment over time. Are you part then of a tradition of embellishing, embroidering a story from the very distant past now?
I'd say I'm part of a tradition of Christian art. And Christian art started very early after the Gospels were written, very early in the catacombs. People began to do little paintings of Jesus raising Lazarus. Christian art started out, and we began to see it develop in the first centuries until finally we saw, you know, the great paintings of the Middle Ages, the statues of the Middle Ages. Then we saw the Renaissance with the magnificent work of Michelangelo and all kinds of different painters. We see it in Rembrandt. We've seen Christian art in the music of Handel, and we've seen it in novels. We've seen great novels in America, like Ben-Hur and The Robe, that have actually brought people to Christ. People have testified that these novels converted them, brought them, got them to go to the Bible. So I see myself more in that tradition. I have great reverence for Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I believe they were inspired. I would not claim to be, you know, on the level at all, ever, of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But the Christian art tradition really did start with Jesus. You know, the Jews did not have pictorial art, and they did have written stories, and they did have apocryphal gospels, those things they did have, but they didn't have any pictorial art. And Christian art really came into being with the Incarnation, and novels, to me, are really part of Christian art. I mean, this is what I hope this is. If this isn't for Jesus, it's worthless.
Let's take a call from Ahmed in Montreal, Canada. Ahmed, you're on the air with Ann Rice and Bill Leonard.
Yeah, hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I'm a Muslim, and in Islam, we view Jesus as a prophet and messenger of God, born from the Virgin Mary. He performed miracles with the permission of God, but not son of God or not divine. Mm-hmm. What I see in this as portraying Jesus as a fictional character, I find it very disrespectful, and I just want to ask the author, how can you do that?
Well, I understand your feeling. I think in the Muslim tradition there is a very different attitude toward art. I respect the fact that you don't do figurative art. You know, this is not something you do, religious figurative art. And I can understand that you don't have a tradition of writing these kind of books. But I do think we have this in Christianity and in Catholicism, and no disrespect is meant. But I deeply respect your tradition too.
Bill Leonard, how do you see Anne Rice's much more recent work in this long lineage of what she calls Christian art? Clearly, it's there in cathedrals and in painting and in literature, but it has been controversial. You go back half a century. You had The Last Temptation of Christ, Kazantzakis, a book. It's not as though, Bill, novelistic attempts to look at this. I mean, Ahmed looks at it from a Muslim point of view and says he feels some offense here. But sure. It's not as though Christians haven't felt that at points as well. What about that, Bill?
No, and Ms. Rice referenced an earlier novels and movies, Ben-Hur, The Robe, Quo Vadis. Often in those movies and books, unlike her novel, Jesus is a kind of ethereal presence who's never shown on the screen and who sort of comes and makes little statements from the Gospels and then is seen no more, and either apostles or fictional characters step in. She really carries us into a more autobiographical side, which I would add a couple of things to that. One is, we have to remind ourselves the Gospels themselves are not biographies. They give us vignettes of Jesus as he moves as teacher and as he moves as prophet and Messiah in a variety of ways in which people read him and his presence. I would say in many ways the Gospels give a variety of pictures. In some ways, Ms. Rice, I think, has Jesus talk like the Gospel of John and act like Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. And those are very distinct pictures of who Jesus is and what Jesus is about that the church reads in a variety of ways.
What's the distinction you're making there, talk like John and act like Mark?
In the Gospel of John, Jesus knows who he is and what he's about, and he makes very clear statements about his relationship to the Father and why he came into the world and what his purpose is. In the Gospel of Mark, probably the first of the Gospels to be written, it's a much more human side of Jesus, much more earthly. In times he tells people when he performs certain acts in the presence of other persons, he often says, please don't tell anyone about this. We have to keep this a secret. And so the division in terms of humanity and divinity finds very clear articulation in those two Gospels. And Matthew and Luke would tend to mirror Mark more than John.
Let's take a call from Watertown, Connecticut, and Renee. Renee, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well.
So it's such a pleasure to talk to the both of you. And I am a native New Orleanian and was raised as a very devout Roman Catholic in the city, and was always just a little creeped and nervous about reading your vampire novels. So I just wanted to tell you that I'm so excited about this upcoming series and getting the chance to read them and actually see Jesus portrayed as a man, because I always felt that his family raised him as a person, even though he was God sent to live among us, and that he was raised with a sense of humor and as a human. And it will be very interesting to see that portrayal. So I'm very happy that this series is out there and we are able to see that side of Jesus.
Renee, thanks for that. Anne Rice, you told USA Today recently that you may indeed write one more vampire book or Lestat book in the Lestat series. You said, I'm thinking about it seriously, but that book, if I do it, would be a Christian book dedicated to the Lord just like the others.
It's not going to happen.
Oh.
This is a retraction.
In the last week, you've changed your mind. Why?
It is not going to happen. I thought about it. I mulled it over. I pondered. I prayed. I meditated. It's not going to happen. I am not going back to those characters. This is really what I want to do right now. And if you'll allow me, I'd like to address what Bill Leonard said about the Gospels being distinct and different.
Mm-hmm.
I think for a person like me who believes totally in Jesus as God and man, I have to harmonize the Gospels. I think anybody writing a life of Jesus is going to harmonize them. I have to find a way in which they are all talking about Jesus as God and man, and I do see them at very much as documents that I can harmonize. The Gospel of John certainly informed this novel, and the Gospel of Matthew was the other Gospel, which I read, and those two Gospels I love above all the others, but I believe all four have to inform the portrait of Jesus in these books.
Renee mentioned that she was a native of New Orleans. You have been famously associated with New Orleans for many, many years, but now have moved to California. Why, Anne?
Well, my husband died, and I was living alone in a very big house in New Orleans. And with my husband's death and with Christopher, my son, having moved to California, I really felt that a chapter of my life had come to a close. I was writing about Jesus. I was working on my biblical research, and I felt moving out to California to be nearer to Christopher and nearer to some other cousins who live out here, nearer to the California family, I felt that was the appropriate thing to do.
Bill Leonard, our time runs down. You're looking on here from Wake Forest, and you're generous in your interpretation of what Anne Rice is up here today, but I wonder if it makes scholars like yourself feel a little bit out of control when a big, powerful novelist comes in and puts her own reading on a sacred text like the Bible. You must be very aware of the power of such a storyteller.
Well, I think it's one way to tell the story, as I've said earlier, and I think that if it encourages people to read the Gospels, to do their own study, to go back to some of these other genres. There's a great deal of literature from in the popular arena and from the scholarly arena on Jesus right now. That there have been a whole series of books written about who Jesus was, what Jesus was about, what these Jesus studies mean. And I think if this encourages people to do that, I'm delighted. A small historical reference, I was very pleased she referenced Sepphoris, which is not mentioned in the Gospels, and which was the big city next door to gossipy Nazareth. And if people begin to study Sepphoris and the kind of place it was that Jesus certainly would have known about, I think it enlarges the picture of Jesus that's in the Gospels. So that in itself is a historical encouragement for further study.
Bill Leonard, Dean of the Divinity School at Wake Forest University, thank you so much for being with us, Professor Leonard.
Thanks.
Anne Rice, last question goes to you. Are you now an evangelist in this series, in these works?
I think they're evangelical, yes, because of what I said earlier. If they don't bring people to Christ, if they don't make people curious about him, if they don't urge people to believe in him and see him in a new way, if they don't do that, then they're worthless. So obviously that's evangelical. I'm trying to spread the word. I am really a total believer. And, this is at the heart of the whole effort. So yes, I would say I am evangelical. Mm.
Ms. Rice, Anne Rice, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Anne Rice, author of Christ the Lord, The Road to Cana. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.